Welcome to the Pathways to Heart podcast series presented by the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning at Sophia University. Sophia University is located in California and offers students a unique educational experience rooted in transformative, transpersonal education. The Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning supports transformative education by creating engaged leaders and learners through resources, trainings, and events. This podcast series focuses on critical emerging issues in our communities. Today's podcast is an interview with Coach Jay Jackson on personal growth through challenge, interviewed by host Tara Papia. Coach Jay Jackson began his career as the assistant wrestling coach at Stanford University, helping the team to the program's first individual NCAA championship. As a high school teacher and assistant principal, Jay worked to build character and resilience in high school students through physical training and sports. He became a Spartan racer and through that relationship created a curriculum to help youth and adults grow into better versions of themselves. Here he shares his insights into personal growth through challenge.
Here we go. Okay. Welcome, Jay Jackson.
Thank you.
And thanks for agreeing to be interviewed. So we'll get right into the questions. You received your bachelor's degree in psychology from Stanford University in 1995. I'm just curious, what made you study psychology?
Just how interesting psychology is. As a freshman, I tried several different courses just to see what I was interested in, and psychology always stuck with me. In particular, the positive psychology portion of it all. So, and I had great psychology professors there. Dr. Phil Zimbardo was one of my professors. So how can you not like psychology with that situation?
And then you went on to get your Master's of Arts in Education, but something led you to that direction. Can you explain what that incident was and how it changed the direction of your life?
Sure. And that's a long story, right. but I'll keep it brief, but I was working in advertising. That's what I was going to use my psychology major for, was to work on the creative side of advertising. And I had gotten an internship at an advertising agency and everything was going according to plan. And then I was also coaching wrestling at Stanford University. And I had somebody come up to me during that time and befriend me and, basically talked his way into my house, saying he had issues with and car problems and couldn't get into his apartment. So I let him stay on my couch. And that night all that was untrue. He was basically stalking me and, came into my room at night with a gun, pulled the gun on me, tied me up and had me there for about an hour and a half. I was able to get myself out of that situation, and hold on to him, and police came and took him away. But after that, when you have a near death situation, a lot of times I haven't had many near death situations, but you're going to really look at your life and say, what am I doing? How much meaning does my life have? And I was looking at the advertising job, and that week I was making a menu for Armadillo Willie's, which is a barbecue restaurant. This is before the internet. So I was going to the library and finding out information about armadillos that I could put on this menu. And I was just thinking to myself, I'm really not producing for the world. So then I started thinking about what is it that I could do that could be a better use of my time. So I thought about being a teacher. And in particular, my dad, who raised me kind of an interesting way, to take on challenges. And he was very demanding and supportive at the same time. I thought, I want to do that. I want to do what my dad did for me, because it helped me, to be honest, helped me get out of that situation I just referred to. And it's something that I think would make, other kids better. So the following year, I applied to go to graduate school, get my master's degree from Pacific Lutheran, and then start a career in education.
So what was it specifically that your dad raised you with that helped you get out of that situation?
So my dad was a PE teacher. He was also a wrestling and football coach. And he was also a former Green Beret, which I didn't know until I was in eighth grade. And one of my classmates came up to me and said, "Hey, I heard your dad was a Green Beret." I said, "Well, no, he wasn't." So, but I went home and I was like, "You know, Dad, were you a Green Beret?" And he was like, "Yeah." And that's all he talked about it for a few years before I started asking more questions. But he always would do things to kind of push us beyond our comfort zone, my brother and sister and I. And he always did in a good way. It was always safe. I knew he was never going to push things really far and make things unsafe. And then also very supportive at the same time, in that, you know, a lot of positive thoughts on the thing, you could do it, that sort of thing. And if things were getting too scary, he was there and he was going to be the safety net that was going to help. So just one example, like we had a boat and he, you know, told my brother and sister and I the boat was out of gas. And then he tied a rope to a life jacket and we all took turns, you know, swimming and towing the boat with the life jacket on. And it took about 2.5 hours and we were pretty tired and exhausted at the end. And then we got to the gas dock and very proud of ourselves. And, you know, he was very proud of us. And then turns out the tank was pretty full. So just things, yeah. Things of that nature, which maybe at the time I wasn't, you know, didn't quite understand why he was doing things, but over time I started realizing, you know, this actually feels good to get challenges. It takes my mind off of other things. And I feel proud of myself and good about myself. So I started, you know, taking that and providing challenges to myself. So I'm very thankful my dad did that. One other thing my dad did, you know, he had my brother and I wrestle blindfolded sometimes. And seems odd, but he was explaining to us that if you wrestle blindfolded, then when you can wrestle non-blindfolded, then you're gonna do much better. You know, and you're gonna understand it's a different frame of reference. And thankfully he did that for us, because in that situation I was in where the burglar pulled a gun on me, the first thing he did was, you know, tie my hands behind my back, my feet together, and he blindfolded me. And I got my hands, when I got my hands out, then I was very confident in that situation, because I'm like, you know, I've wrestled blindfolded with my brother. I know what this is all about. I just need to make sure that I can, you know, if this guy, you know, gets close enough where I can get my hands free and I can grab him, I'm going to be, you know, okay in that situation. So, again, at the time you would look at that from the outside and say that makes no sense. You'd say my dad's crazy, but obviously it worked out well for me.
Now, was your father alive when that incident happened?
He was.
And what was that conversation like?
That was interesting. You know, I told him and you know, I just, in a situation like that, you're just going to tell someone very quickly and just hang up the phone and let them process it. And how my dad talked to me later, how he processed that situation is he was thinking, you know, okay. And he was like walking to school, because he taught that day, and he's like, my son's tough. You know, I raised my son and he's tough. And he was all proud. And then he just stopped in his tracks and thought, you know, I really could have lost my son today. And, you know, emotionally kind of broke down at that moment. And my dad's the toughest guy I know, but emotions happen to everybody and they're important. And he kind of broke down and, you know, called for a substitute and said, I'm going to take the day off. So he came back home so he could emotionally process the whole situation.
It's almost like it came full circle. Like he gave you a gift at that young age.
Correct.
And thankfully you were able to understand and see the positives in it. Cause I could see being as a young kid, a little frustrated by it and never knowing what he's going to throw at you, but it seems like you understood it even when you were younger.
Right. And again, that's because he did that consistently. Okay. It wasn't like once every month, we're going to do something, you know, that's going to challenge you and push you beyond what's comfortable. It was pretty consistent. There were days where we didn't do anything, but you know, like for my brother, you know, he challenged my brother to run 100 miles, not all at once. But over, you know, 3 months or so. And you know, those type of things that my brother didn't really want to do, but he stuck to it and he did it. And then, you know, he felt good about that. And you can, those things build someone's confidence. They expand your comfort zone. And again, all good stuff that I can thank my dad for.
And now with this master's in education, you started to teach, correct? And right now we're in Irvington High School, which you're a teacher here now. Is that correct? But while you were at one point an assistant principal, is that when you created the curriculum that is basically based on the things your father taught you, the grit, the resilience, the overcoming challenges? So that was while you were assistant principal?
Right.
You came up with that?
Well, okay. Technically, before I was an assistant principal, the principal called me into the office and said, we're going to start a sports psychology class and you're going to teach it. And being someone that likes challenges, because that's the way I was raised, I was excited about that. And I asked, is there a textbook? And the principal said, no. And I said, are there state standards? He said, no. I said, then I can teach anything I want to. And he's like, yes, you can. So I was excited about that. I had a chance to teach the sports psychology class and started doing research on that pretty immediately. And there's a couple different kinds of character. There's moral character, and then there's performance character. And there's a couple other kinds of character, but those are the two main ones. And so I wanted this class to focus on performance character. Obviously, there's a place for moral character in that, but performance character is how can somebody be the best that they can possibly be in any challenge? And then I wanted to add to that, how can you be successful? And then how can you be happy at the same time? That's my concern, because I work in a school where the kids, they work really hard and they are successful, but they're not happy. And what's the point? What's the point of being successful if you're not happy along the way? So started doing a lot of research with that and, you know, finding out what I wanted to teach. And for the first couple of years, kind of experimenting with different things. And by the third year, I had kind of realized that I needed visuals with that. And so what I've done with the curriculum is taken all these performance character concepts from sports psychology and also, you know, positive psychology, made very simple diagrams with them that when coupled with questions can get kids thinking about their personal ideas about performance character concepts. Mm-hmm. So I know that as a teacher, if I get up there and lecture to them that this is what you need to do, it's going to be different for every individual kid and they're not going to listen to me. However, if I have a visual up there and I ask them questions and they're constructing their own knowledge, then that's something they're going to remember. Plus, all these performance character things are different, like I said, for every individual. So someone's comfort zone might be different than someone else's. So that's a different conversation. And I don't know, it's something that I wanted to be able to use for myself, but I also want other teachers to be able to use it. Because when I became an assistant principal, again, just like the sports psychology class was kind of volunteered to do that, but told to do that.
Right, voluntold.
Exactly. You're going to get teachers and students coming in that are having issues, you know, with gaining success and happiness and stuff. And what I would do is test out these diagrams that I had created for class and would use them to have conversations with people. And that's a much different conversation. If I'm telling a student, like, you shouldn't do this, you know, because it's bad, as opposed to me showing them, okay, here's this diagram. Where do you think you are in this diagram and how does it make you feel? Now it's a different conversation. I'm not coming down on someone saying you have to do this. We're having a discussion where, you know, we're talking. And kids might have a different idea of things than I do, which is totally fine. I now have a better idea of where they come from. So for example, I've got a diagram that talks about, you know, success and honor and which one's important. Is it better to be, everyone wants success with honor, but is it better to have success dishonorably or is it better to fail honorably? Which one's the better situation? I think personally, my thought is it's better to fail honorably than to have success dishonorably, but students have different opinions on that and different reasons why. And at least I know where they're coming from, you know? So it helps me build relationships with students too, just by having these discussions.
And is that a scale? The honorably, like succeed dishonorably, fail honorably. Is it like a spectrum? when you're telling them that?
So what I do on this one, it's
the quadrant.
It's quadrant situation. Okay. So here, this line is success and failure, and this line is honor and dishonor. Everyone wants to succeed honorably. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to fail dishonorably. And then my question is, let's look at these two quadrants. Is it better to fail, you know, fail honorably or succeed dishonorably? And that's a good discussion, and it can lead Absolutely. To it can lead to a lot of things, especially in a school where you have the ability to cheat all around you. Would you rather cheat and get the A, or would you rather Right. get the B or C and then really work for it? So it's a discussion that I don't think a lot of kids are having. They just kind of do, as opposed to really thinking about those things. So I want to give them an opportunity to think about it.
And now this, all these thoughts and diagrams and the curriculum with sports psychology, that eventually became a collaboration with Spartan Race. Is that correct? How did that relationship form, and what does that curriculum look like? Is it the same, or?
That's a crazy story. So I'd been working on this for a while, and you know, and I was still an assistant principal, and I had been an assistant principal for 4 years. So I kept adding more diagrams because I secretly wanted to be back in the classroom, and you know, I was thinking about all these things. And the same friend I referred to that came to me in eighth grade and told me my dad was a Green Beret. Mm-hmm. He went to some dinner function in New York with Joe DeSena, who's the CEO and founder of Spartan Race. So Nick Morris is my friend's name, and Nick Morris went to this dinner with Joe, and I hadn't talked to Nick for about 25 years. And at the same time, he's meeting with them. I'm working on a presentation. It's my first year of being an assistant principal. And the principal told me, you're going to give a presentation to the staff, which I was super excited about, because that's when you, as a teacher, you really bring your A game, because teaching to a bunch of teachers, you've got to do things well. I don't want anyone, you know, take working on correcting papers. I want them focused on what we're talking about. So I was thinking about what I was going to do. And I was watching this 60 minutes sports episode. And it was about ops course racing, and they interviewed Joe DeSena. And I was first time I'd ever seen him. And I was like, what he's saying makes a whole lot of sense with school, because you want to challenge people. You don't want, and this, again, this goes back to my dad, but you want to challenge people. You want to be demanding, you want to be supportive at the same time. He said, if they do something difficult, then at the end of the race, they're going to hug you and thank you for it. And that's what I wanted to get across to our staff. Like, we need to be challenging and supportive. And then at the end of everything, the kids are going to be thankful for it and grateful. So I was making a PowerPoint with that presentation. At the same time, Nick is talking to Joe, and he tells him my story about getting, you know, tied up and blindfolded by gunpoint. And Nick sends me an email next day, and he's like, hey, I met this guy named Joe DeSena, CEO and founder of Spartan Race, you know, told him your story, you know, he'd like to meet you. And I said, that's crazy, because I'm just making a PowerPoint on this very guy. So yeah, you know, I want to meet him. So Joe flew down to Monterey, California. There's a race here. I had no idea what ops course racing was about. The only thing I knew is from that TV show. So I, you know, Joe came down and met him at the race course, and it was shocking how many people showed up. And, you know, I didn't realize it was such a big thing. And then I'm talking to Joe for a while, and, you know, he wants to know about this story where I got tied up at gunpoint, and how my dad, you know, was related to that, and things of that nature. And then he's like, hey, I've got to go answer some emails. Do you mind? Do you want to, you know, just hang out? Do you want to check out the obstacles? Do you want to run the race? I said, well, yeah, I'll run the race. And I'm wearing khakis and not running shoes and a long sleeve cotton shirt. And, you know, Joe brings me up to the front, and there's about 40 people getting ready for the race, and they, you know, shirtless and, you know, face paint, and they're very excited. And the announcer says, this is Jay Jackson. He's a personal friend of Joe DeSena, and he's the guy to beat in this heat. And they're like, yeah. And I was just kind of looking around, like, how did I get in this situation? And we head out, and we've gone for about 3 miles, and I'm tired. I hadn't been training at all. And, the race I saw on, on 60 Minutes was about 3 miles. So I was had gone about 3 miles, like looking for the finish line. And then I see this sign that says 10 miles to your ice cold Sierra Nevada. And I looked to the guy next to me. I'm like, how long is this race? And he's like, this is the beast. I was like, what's a beast? And he said, a beast is 13 miles. And so now I'm really in it. And it was perfect though, because it's exactly what I was talking about. You know, I want to challenge myself beyond my comfort zone. And this was, I was ready to stop and I had 10 more miles to go. And it's not an easy 10 miles, as you know, it's up and down and different obstacles and things like that. And I was dying and wearing khakis and all the reasons to stop.
That was my question. Did you still have the khakis on?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then at the, you know, at the end, I was able to do it. You know, I so badly wanted to quit during that time, and that's what I do every time I'm challenged something beyond my comfort zone. My brain tells me to quit. I've got a diagram for that too. but I was able to finish. And at the end, I was very proud of myself. And I was like, that's exactly what I want, you know, for students. So at the end of the race, Joe talks to me. He's like, number one, he goes, I don't want to work with someone that can't run a beast. So he said, I know you can do that now. He goes, what do you think about doing an educational component to our brand? So I thought about that. And again, that's a challenge. So let's go. So I had my sports psychology class before. I had these diagrams, but it wasn't terribly organized, you know, yet. Mm-hmm. And this opportunity allowed me to really think about, you know, what components of performance character are very important and what diagrams can teach that. So it allowed me to really, really focus and hone what I wanted to teach and how I wanted to teach it. So it turned into a very much more streamlined curriculum mm-hmm. than I had before.
And this is called Spartan Edge?
It was called Spartan Edge, but then Spartan had an online program called Spartan Edge that wanted to use the name. I let that happen. So right now I don't know what it's called.
Okay. And where is this? Is the curriculum they practice it here at Irvington High School and some other places?
So I've been able to train a number of teachers. I don't want to use the word train. I would be able to have discussions with a number of teachers on how to use the tools. Mm-hmm. And again, these are tools. It's not like a curriculum where someone has to go through these things. A teacher can use these tools however they want to, whenever they want to. And again, they're diagrams that coupled with questions lead to discussion. And I think how it should work is you have the diagram, you talk it through with a peer as a teacher, with a peer or a collaborative team, you know, of teachers. Mm-hmm. So everyone kind of understands the concept. And then you have that diagram, you're going to bring it in front of your class and have that discussion and get student ideas on what they think about that, you know, particular performance character concept. And then what I suggest, and the teacher doesn't have to do this, but what I suggest and what I use in my classroom is I want to assess it. So kids can say one thing, but if presented with the situation, they might do something completely different. So like, for example, we have a conversation about comfort zones, and I'll do this in my class, and I've got other teachers doing this. So we'll talk about comfort zones, and they'll talk about why it's important to go outside your comfort zone and, you know, how far mm-hmm. you should go and things like that. And then after, what I do is I usually in my lesson about the French Revolution, I have students do an interpretive dance in groups, a 10-act interpretive dance of the French Revolution. So they have to pick the 10 most important parts or people in the French Revolution, and then they have to do an interpretive dance with different music for every section, and, you know, that it's explaining, you know, what happened during the French Revolution, which is outside the comfort zone of a lot of the students. And I'm not asking them to, you know, do pirouettes and stag leaps and things of that nature, but I do want them to be a little bit uncomfortable. And then we can talk about, not only do they learn about the French Revolution, but they're testing comfort zones. Like, did they go out of their comfort zones? How did it feel, you know, when they went out of their comfort zones? How did it feel before, during, after those? Would they ever do it again? You know, how can this benefit them? So again, I want to teach the content, which is very important, you know, to teach mm-hmm. the world history content, but I also want to teach these character traits. So that's how I do it. And I've got, like I said, I've been able to train a number of teachers, actually a lot of PE teachers, because this was a Spartan program. We've got a lot of PE teachers in this, but classroom teachers use as well, including myself. Mm-hmm. And I've got two schools, one in West Virginia and one in Denver, that use the curriculum school-wide, which has been very neat to see, because my curriculum is fairly simple. Mm-hmm. And it's been amazing watching some teachers take this very simple curriculum and, you know, have it blossom. So basically I'm giving them seeds. They take it, make it their own, and you've got these full-fledged gardens. The one in West Virginia is incredibly interesting because they started with these diagrams pre-K. Mm-hmm. And the woman there, Jennifer Dawes Brazier, says that, you know, just giving them visuals allows them an opportunity to talk about these things, which is, these are kind of abstract concepts. And without the visuals, it's hard to talk with, you know, 4 and 5 year olds about this. But she said they get it, you know, and then she's had them for about four or five years now. So these kids have been working with these diagrams for, you know, 4 or 5 years, which has been pretty awesome. And she'll send me stuff. And again, what I do is simple. Jennifer has taken this stuff and created this wonderful school, you know, that uses these things as a tool to enhance her program. So it's been very neat to see.
And it's nice you can use it with different subjects. There's a lot of visual learners too. So history was difficult for me.
Yeah.
But the visual, the dance, and all those things that go along with it, I think can help the kids who, you know, learn in different ways, not just lecture.
Right.
So.
And I look at the projects, the open-ended projects, like the dance. Mm-hmm. It's like an obstacle in a Spartan race, right? You know, no one's going to remember the flatland jogging. You know, what you're going to remember is the going over the wall or climbing the rope, or those are things you're going to talk about afterwards. It's just like school, you know, lecture and worksheets. Those are just like a flatland marathon. You got to give them obstacles. I would say academic obstacles where they can, you know, they're going to try harder. And just recently I was doing a unit on courage in my sports psychology class, and had the kids, they either had to do a comedy routine or a dance or sing karaoke in front of a group of people. And it was based on their level of comfort. Some were just in front of one or two people at home, some in front of our class, some in front of other classes. I just kind of lost my train of thought there. What was it?
Oh, we're talking about the obstacles in the classroom, like a race. We're sharing a lot.
Exactly. But that's the kind of thing they're going to remember. Definitely. No kid's going to, you know, talk to their grandkids about, hey, remember that time, you know, that amazing lecture I went to, or that amazing worksheet I saw. Everyone's going to talk about the time where they, you know, challenged themselves a little bit and did something, you know, outside the realm of what was comfortable. So that's, as a teacher, you do need the lectures every so often, but just like a Spartan race, you're running here, mm-hmm. but then let's do something challenging that's going to make you, you're going to remember it and how you felt and things of that nature.
And then you're proud of yourself too.
Exactly.
So you also are involved with Beat the Streets.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that is? Cause you've made a difference there as well.
So Beat the Streets is wrestling is my sport. And my dad, again, my wrestling coach, and wrestled, you know, through college, and I'm coaching wrestling right now. Beat the Streets is it's a wrestling nonprofit for inner city youth, where you're going to bring wrestling in to use it as a vehicle to teach young people, you know, lessons about, you know, how to become better wrestlers, but more importantly, how to become better people, mm-hmm. that can, you know, have a more successful, happy and fulfilling life. So, my stuff meets, it meshes right with their mission statement. And, you know, I love wrestling, and it was just kind of a no brainer to join up with them. And Spartan is involved in wrestling now too. So, you know, it all made sense. So while you're, and I do this with my wrestling team as well, you know, every so often, once a week or so, we'll have a diagram, we'll discuss it. And then we're being very intentional about, you know, this is what you can do to make yourself better, or, you know, how do you want to think about, you know, making yourself more successful and happier at the same time. So again, perfect, mm-hmm. perfect marriage, and love what they're doing. That program's been around for quite some time, and I'm trying to help it in Bay Area Beat the Streets. And then hopefully we can expand it beyond that.
So with all these things coming together, you're teaching the sports psychology and the diagrams in the classroom, you're spreading the word to other teachers. Then we have Spartan Edge, or whatever the new version of the name is, the curriculum, but Spartan, Beat the Streets. And what I hear throughout all of these is stepping out of your comfort zone. So how can you connect stepping out of your comfort zone and also being happy along the journey? Like, I know you said happiness is another important thing.
Sure.
So how do those two relate, or do they?
They do. And I think it was, Hunter S. Thompson, is that his name? Author. But he basically said there's two types of people. There's swimmers and floaters. Okay. A swimmer is going to pursue a goal and commit to the goal and go towards it. And the other person is just going to float through life. To me, there are times to float, but I think it's so much better. You're thriving in life if you're swimming towards something. And that's going to, we talked about pride. It's going to make you proud. Mm-hmm. I just want kids to try that and to push people outside their comfort zone. You're kind of encouraging them to swim. So I'm giving you this opportunity to swim towards something. And I want, if you take that opportunity at the end of it, it takes effort and it's difficult and it's going to take deliberate practice and focus. But at the end of the day, you're going to be proud of yourself. And I think pride and happiness mm-hmm. are definitely related. I also think if you understand why you're doing something, why I'm heading towards a challenge, mm-hmm. then, you're going to be much happier about it as opposed to being a victim to it. And like, my teacher's forcing me to do this. Right. But if you're like, this is a great opportunity for me to better myself, and you have that good why, and that's good. Then with that why, you have that purpose why you're going somewhere. If you can couple emotion with that, mm-hmm. Where it makes you feel good, and purpose coupled with emotion, for me, that's passion. And if that's the hardest thing to teach someone to have, is a passion towards something. For me, teaching is kind of a passion because I connect it to that incident I had where I was, tied up at gunpoint. And those were not good emotions, but they also elicited positive emotions because of what my dad taught me, all this pride, and I was able to get out of that situation. And these emotions are all coupled up with my purpose to teach, which is to make kids more successful and happier. So anytime I start, if I'm teaching, I start getting tired or, not as involved as I should be, I can bring those emotions back, and then it fuels my passion more. And we've talked about this, you and I have talked about this outside, but, mm-hmm. If you can get kids focusing more on the process, mm-hmm. and what they're doing, why they're doing it, and why that's good, and improvement that leads to pride, then that's a lot more fun than just outcome based goals. If their goal is just to get an A in class and they just do it, then that doesn't feel good. It's like checking something off the box, as opposed to someone that's just going to focus on, oh, wow, look at how much I've learned throughout this process. And this is great.
And one of the things that stood out, we were talking about with Joe DeSeno about burpees. Like he had mentioned, if the bell goes off in class and all the kids did like a minute of burpees at a time or something, whenever the bell would go off, they'd be out of their comfort zone. They might not want to do it. But you had said, you think most of the kids would do it, if not all of them, because they're going to see other kids doing it, being uncomfortable, and they'd be more uncomfortable not doing it. It's going to push them. It's almost like a chain reaction. Right. And then they may all do that. And it's uncomfortable. No one wants to do burpees for a minute, much less 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. So that reminded me of there's the individual transcendence. We have talked about the flow state, like when you're on a run, like the runner's high, where you kind of transcend yourself. Right. But there's also a group transcendence, which would be similar to like maybe a wrestling match. There's more than one people. There's a crowd and a Spartan race. When you did that 10 miles or that 13 mile run, you had 10 miles left. There was someone else next to you with you.
Right.
So in respect to individual transformation and group transformation, have you experienced one or both? And which one would you think is more powerful?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I'm not sure I can answer it for myself.
That's a tough one. So mm-hmm. with flow state, I would say this. First of all, flow state leads to joy. And the reason why there's a difference between enjoyment and pleasure. Pleasure is I don't have to work for something, but it feels good. And that's pleasurable. So pleasure could be me watching TV or eating some food someone made for me that's really delicious. Enjoyment is different because it is you have to work for it. And there's joy involved in that. So if I get myself to flow state, that's enjoyment. So I have to start with having a passion for something, persevere, and passion for perseverance leads to grit. And if I'm attacking some challenge, every so often that ability is going to meet my skill level, or my ability is going to meet the challenge. Sure. If they're at the same thing, then that could lead to flow state where I'm so focused on what I'm doing that it's stir is the acronym. It's selfless. You feel like you're one with the universe. It's timeless. You know, time can speed up or slow down. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really matter. And with selfless, your ego kind of goes away.
So the I and the R left.
Oh, there's E and E and R. And now I'm trying to think of what it is.
Euphoria?
No, it's not euphoria. But I should have my notes. But it's wonderful feeling,
right,
where it's
all around,
timeless. Right. You feel like it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to get there. But the only way to get there is to really push toward the challenge and, you know, have, again, your skill level match the, you know, challenge you're giving yourself. And if you find yourself there, you always want to find a way back there. And it's just that's where joy comes from. And I've only had a couple like really deep flow states before in my life, you know, but I'm still chasing those things. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll pursue challenges because I want to get to that experience again. Now, if you're on a team where, and you know, everyone's working so together and everyone's so focused on what they're doing, where the team reaches flow state, gosh, I think that would be the ultimate, wouldn't it? If you can, like, I'm just looking at it from a class perspective. If I give students a challenge in class that they're really into, I know they're in flow state if the bell rings and they're like surprised by the bell.
Right.
And that's the goal, is to get as many kids as you can in flow state. One kid in flow state is great. Mm-hmm. If you can get the entire class in flow state, that's the ultimate. But that's difficult because different kids have different levels of ability, and you've got to find open-ended challenges, projects in class that they can do where they can reach that ability. And I'm going to say this too, and I'm kind of rambling, but for teachers, our job, I think, is to create opportunities for kids to do that. So like my dance situation, that creates an opportunity where kids can challenge themselves up to what I'm giving them.
Okay.
In this dance, it's open-ended. They have a way to challenge themselves, but it's also the student's responsibility to challenge themselves. Some people, I'm going to give them that dance project and they're not going to do much, in which case they can't get the flow.
Right.
They've got to be the ones that meet me halfway. And here's the open-ended project. And then they're going to try hard enough where their ability matches the challenge of what I'm giving them. So, but if you can get, like, to answer your question, mm-hmm. I can't think of anything better than a whole class of students, you know, in flow. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how often that would happen. I know in the military, it's, you know, they're special forces teams that they're really working on trying to get the whole team into flow state. And they've got some ways that they're working on that.
Well, you saying that made me think of like an orchestra, like how everyone plays together. It's more impactful for the audience and maybe for them than being just not that a soloist isn't enjoyable, but there's something special about a whole arena of people playing in unison. And that's, I think, on like that Spartan race that you did, if you were doing that by yourself, the 13 miles, and you looked at that sign and said, I have 10 more miles to go. It's a big difference with that, with someone next to you also doing it, whether you're behind him, next to him, beside him, and then other people with you. So I agree that would be the ultimate. And in a classroom, you watching the whole class in flow versus one person must be an amazing feeling. because you're creating that or helping that facilitate
it. And the best part of that is whether it's an individual or a group, everyone's got problems in their life and anxieties and things they're thinking about. But if you get to flow state and you're so focused on what you're doing, those things go away. You're not thinking about those things anymore. And that's even if that happens for an hour or mm-hmm. just a few minutes, that's better than it not happening at all. So like we go and we work out and we have just looking out to the field there, mm-hmm. you know, you and I'll go work out, with Spartan obstacles and whatnot. And the greatest thing there is I have lots of things going on, but while I'm climbing over an 8-foot wall, I'm not thinking about those things because I've got to focus all my attention on that. Right. And if I'm going hard enough out here, then I've got an hour where I'm not really thinking about other things going on in my life. I'm thinking about just the moment right now, which is why I'm so drawn to this and why I want kids thinking like this is a great, every challenge I get is a great opportunity for me to not only be successful, because if I'm driving towards that challenge and working towards it, I've got a chance of being successful, but I'm also going to be happy because I'm in that flow state where I'm not thinking about my other problems.
Absolutely. And we talked a lot about your dad and how all this whole path, a lot of it, you attribute to your father. We had it played a role in right. the way that you think and the direction your life has gone. But your mom also, you had mentioned, she had the rule of three, which correct. I also think was great for developing character. So explain what the rule of three is that your mom.
So my dad was big on physical mm-hmm. challenges. My mom more on the social challenges. And her rule of three was every time you meet somebody for the first time, you've got to ask them three questions about themselves. And it's such a great thing. And I didn't want to do it. It was outside of my comfort zone when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And she was very diligent and, you know, standing there and, you know, ask three questions until it became a habit. And it became comfortable for me. But what a great learning tool, you know, for me, not only getting out of your comfort zone, but getting to know somebody, being selfless, finding out about them. It's just a skill that I'm really grateful for, that I would not have done without my mom, you know, pushing that.
Do you still do that today?
100%.
I'm trying to remember the first day we met, if you asked me three questions. I know you spoke to me for a while. You gave me your attention.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember. And speaking of that day, you talked about in the beginning, the transformative experience when you were in that near death situation. You were in almost a near death situation the day that I met you.
Correct.
So can you briefly explain what happened then and how that changed your life again?
Yeah. No, we talked, we met, and I was very excited to meet you because brand new to our community here and also really a superstar, you know. So I was excited about that, and your energy was great. And we talked for about 7 to 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards I started my warm up. I jogged around the track and I was doing monkey bars. And in the middle of the monkey bars, I stopped. And that's usually very easy for me, but in the middle of it, I couldn't figure out how to move from there. So I just chalked it up to maybe I had sore shoulders that day and I dropped down. And the next thing was to do split squats, which is you have one leg forward, one leg back, and then you switch it, keep going back and forth. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out how to do those. And that's something that's normal to me. So I went over to the coach here, you know, Ty, and I was like, yeah, Ty, I don't feel that good. And, you know, and I kind of started staggering, and what I had was I was having a stroke. So I had what's called an AVM, arteriovenous malformation, in my left front lobe. And it was, you know, it was a situation where I'm born with it and it's just going to explode at some time. And it chose that moment to explode. So I got all this blood in my gray matter, and I didn't realize it at the time, but what a weird experience. It's just like, I understood words and stuff, but I didn't care about them. And I was kind of drifting off into being one with the universe, and kind of felt good, but I also didn't know why it was happening. So it was not a good combination. So as I sat there, As I sat there, my whole right side started not working, became paralyzed. I didn't know that at the time because I was, again, focused on other things. But they took me to the hospital, and I got to Stanford Hospital, and there's a much too young looking doctor that came in, and he basically said, you had a major bleed in your left frontal lobe. And he said, this is going to be a big challenge for you to come back. It's going to be a long process. And that's when I clicked in. Like when he said challenge, I was like, this is going to be great. I started thinking to myself, this is a great opportunity. I've had these, you know, I've got these diagrams. I've had these discussions with kids. I've had these discussions with teachers. I've had these discussions with Joe connected me to, you know, amazing athletes like yourself, that I could have these discussions with. And so I knew how I wanted to take on a challenge best I could. And, you know, when it came to this, it was a several month process coming back, and I spent a month in a rehab facility and things of that nature. But I was, this sounds weird, but I was excited to do it because this is a way to test my thoughts on, you know, performance, character, and what a, I mean, if we're talking, yeah. if we're talking full circle, right. what an opportunity for me. So, and I will say this, that, you know, when I was leaving that rehab facility, I had a few doctors come in, you know, separately. And, you know, it was all the same questions like, hey, you know, what are you doing? You know, cause it's, you know, your recovery was pretty amazing. You know, how are you doing it? And, you know, basically I think it's all positive psychology. I think it's just taking the time to think about how you best want to, you know, take on a challenge. And I think focusing on the process as opposed to like, mm-hmm. if I would have focused on the outcome of getting all my motion back on my right side, then I would not be happy until I got all my motion back on my right side. I would be bitter. And there are a lot of bitter people in that rehab facility. But every day I got a little bit better. Like one day I, you know, can move my finger just a little bit. Wow. And that's a celebration. You know, you're getting better at things. And if you're focused on the improvement and the process, then I think you're a lot happier. And I love the fact that I was able to do the research on these things, discuss how I want to take them on. And then just like I would, you know, give a project to my kids in class, here it was, you know, for me, where I got to test myself on it. I knew what I wanted to do. Now I got to assess myself on that situation. And again, I keep saying this, but, you know, great opportunity for me.
And now you're writing a book. Is that correct?
Correct.
And does that, do you think that scenario motivated you to do that, to write the book, or had you always been thinking about it?
The book situation, I always kind of staved that off because, you know, I've got a lot going on. But I just, this stuff, I know it can be helpful. And I know that I've come up with a simple way for teachers to introduce performance character into their classes. So I wanted to share that. And if we're talking about, if my purpose is in life and my passion is that I want to help young people be better versions of themselves and happier versions of themselves, then this is kind of a no-brainer. I had to ask myself, you know, it's going to take a lot of work, and it's not easy. Writing a book is not easy, as you know, with your dissertation. It's and we've talked about this too. It's a labor of love, but it's definitely labor. And there are problems, there's mistakes along the way, just like any challenge.
Right.
But it's feeding my passion. And if I'm taking time with it, but moving forward consistently, then it's something that can help out even a few people, then it's worth it.
And is it about all the things we've been talking about, just a culmination of diagrams and thought processes? And
it's mostly research based. So okay. there are some stories in there, but mostly research on, let's say, deliberate practice. So I'll talk about deliberate practice and where it came from, and, you know, Anders Ericsson, and, you know, bringing all this research, and then share the diagram and questions that the teacher can use to ask students. Now, and I also know those questions can be altered by the teacher too, based on the age and based on the class and the experience with the students. So, but just want to give an idea of here's something you can use and a tool. And then the next chapter will be, you know, the final chapter is a chapter on flow. We talk about Csikszentmihalyi and how flow came to be, and you know, ideas about that. And then each section will have a diagram. And I believe there's 24 total diagrams in there that teacher can use with their class. So I wouldn't expect a teacher to hit all 24 in a mm-hmm. year, but you know as a teacher what your students need. And then, you know, the hope is that, you know, coaches can use it too, sports coaches, individuals can look at it. It's the book is based, it's specifically for teachers, mm-hmm. but I think the concepts apply to sports psychology, positive psychology concepts apply to every area in life, whether it be academics, sports, relationships, all those things.
And how close are you to finishing it? Like in the home stretch?
We talked about this earlier too, yeah. But as I got to the final chapter, for some reason in my mind, when I get close to finishing something, mm-hmm. then I start thinking about being done with it and it takes longer.
Right.
So as I got to the final chapter, you know, which is odd because I've got a diagram about that, you know, so I wrote about it. I knew I wrote this thing in there saying, I know when I get to the end of this book, it's going to be hard for me to do this. And I still had the issue and, you know, fight my way through it, but I'm done with the first draft of the manuscript. And now is when I'm working with one editor, but now 10 editors are going to come in okay. and really pick it apart, which I have to, you know, I'm bracing myself for that. Because that's going to be a lot of work too, but, you can see it as a threat, mm-hmm. that they're going to rip this thing apart. It's going to be a lot of work, or you can see it as an opportunity where, they're going to help me become a better writer and the book's going to be better. It's going to be more user-friendly and things of that nature. So I've got to accept, mm-hmm. I've got to accept that coming up rather than resist it. So
it's your next obstacle.
Yeah.
So what, and you have to come up with a title, is that correct?
I do.
Okay. So we'll look forward to what the title of the book, and I'd love to read it once it's completed. And then what's next, do you know, after this? Too soon to tell?
I don't know. I do know, I mean, the main reason I want to write the book is so that I can do professional developments with teachers. And, you know, and for me, professional developments, we do a poor job in education with professional developments because unfortunately over 90% of professional developments are a PowerPoint presentation with a lecture, which is modeling the worst thing you can do in teaching. So what I want to do is give professional developments where it's going to be more of a discussion, mm-hmm. use a tool, understand the discussion, and then brainstorm ideas that individual teachers can use that are at the professional development on how they could introduce this diagram, this concept into their math curriculum and what math challenge they might give kids that would assess not only the math but the performance character trait as well. So that's what I'd like to do, and we'll see how that goes.
So we'll have to have another interview, and then once that manifests, we could talk about your professional development career. It sounds like it's going to happen because everything else you've made happen. So thank you for giving us your time, Jay, and I look forward to reading your book and talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
For more podcasts or information on educational programs at Sophia University, go to www.sophia.edu. Thank you for listening.